drawing near. Brothers, sisters, please get ready.
Welcome. You are tuned into KKRN Community Radio out of Round Mountain and Bella Vista, California. And this is Bending the Arc. Bending the Arc is a show sponsored by the Shasta Equal Justice Coalition. And it's a show where we interview people in our communities, especially Shasta County, that are working for equal justice and criminal legal reform. And we've interviewed a number of different people on our show, if you've been following us. And we were very excited to learn about a new immigration lawyer in Shasta County. And in this conversation, we speak with her about her work, about how she came to return to the area, and some of the changes that she would like to see in the system. And as we talk, you'll learn about her passion for her work and also some of the challenges that her clients face. So I hope you enjoy this session. As always, we put a lot of links in the show notes. You can go to kkrn.org/bendingthearc, and you can find all of our past shows archived there. And while you're on the website, you might check out our donate button. There are a number of us volunteers, including those running the station, who work really hard to bring local information and music and entertainment to you. And any money that you send really supports the equipment, rentals, all of the many things that we do to engage and provide a space for. Today, I am pleased to be speaking to someone who works in the realm of immigration law here in Reading. And I wanted to start by having you introduce yourself.
Hi, thank you for having me. It's my pleasure. My name is Tanya Narciso. I am a solo practitioner here in Reading. So I only exclusively practice immigration law, and I have been doing so for about 6 years now. I grew up in Reading, but I did move away to Sacramento for about 15 years, went to UC Davis, then McGeorge School of Law in Sacramento. And then about a year and a half ago, I decided to move back to Reading. And so I realized that there were no immigration attorneys as I was looking for a job. And so I just decided to branch out and start my own practice. So I've been doing that now for about a year and a half.
Wonderful. Yeah. When I heard about you, I was so excited to hear that you were in the community. Definitely a need for, yes, for those services. What drew you initially to immigration law?
It started when I took a course in my undergrad at UC Davis. So I had a minor in Chicano studies, and one of the courses that I took was on border relations. And so we discussed immigration at the border, and it really drew me to immigration law. So when I went to law school at McGeorge, they have an immigration clinic. And so they have students who work on actual cases for people in the community, and it's pro bono work. So we're supervised by other attorneys and professors. So I started volunteering my first year right away. I really wanted to get involved. And then from then on, I went to work at the actual immigration clinic for my remaining 2 years. And then I was a clerk for a law firm in Sacramento that's only specialized in immigration law. And so that just kind of solidified my passion.
Many of the people I've interviewed often get into a profession and they have one idea about what it's like, the actual practice of it, and are often surprised by what is really required. Was there anything like that for you that surprised you about the actual practice of immigration law?
Yes, I would say just the ever-changing legal landscape. So things change all the time. So, and it really does have a lot to do with who we have as a president, and just the times we live in. So that really surprised me.
Mm-hmm. It, as an outsider, I am not in that field. It seems like a particularly challenging time, let's say the last 8 years or so, to be practicing immigration law. How has that affected your practice or what you see among other immigration lawyers?
Where I was working before at the law firm in Sacramento, I mean, I started in 2017, so I it was like an uphill battle from the beginning, honestly. And then from then on, when things kind of changed, the administration changed in 2020, then things kind of became, I wouldn't say easy, but there were some doors that were opened. And so I have seen us kind of being a little bit busier at times than other, like if there are some doors that open, then obviously we just get a lot more phone calls, people wondering what are these changes about, and then maybe more people coming in for consults. So I do see kind of that being affecting like the practice.
Mm-hmm. And how do you explain to a community member who's not familiar with immigration law what it is you do?
I would say we help people legalize their immigration status. And within immigration law, there are many different fields. So for example, employment, student, family, immigration. So it really varies. It's really different. It's like asking a surgeon to perform heart surgery when they're like brain surgeon. So it could be very different. So for example, I practice in family immigration. So we help people who are living in the U.S., U.S. citizens or residents who want to bring their relatives from abroad here to the U.S. lawfully, or maybe people who are already in the U.S. who want to try to legalize their immigration status. We also help with humanitarian visas. We help with people in removal proceedings, so in removal defense. So I just basically explain that we try to help people with people's legal status, but there are many different areas within immigration law.
So I'm wondering if, I think we have, there are a lot of assumptions out there about why someone doesn't have a legal immigration status. Could you speak to some of the situations that you encounter where you're helping someone to formalize or legalize their status?
Yeah, the most common scenarios are, for example, people who have already been living here for many, many years, maybe over 30 years, who were brought as children, for example. And the deferred action for childhood arrivals are for those specific people who were brought as children. So no fault of their own. Obviously, there are some other people who also came at a very young age and just have been living their entire lives here in the U.S., pay their taxes. They have never gotten into any sort of trouble with the law. So they just remained here in the U.S. There are also those people who maybe are recent arrivals who are seeking asylum from their countries based on past persecution. And there are also people who have been here and who are detained by ICE. And so now they're in removal proceedings and they need legal representation for their cases. So there are different scenarios for people who find themselves in that situation.
Mm-hmm. Do you have many people who had some kind of status or visa where that it's been difficult to renew and come to you for help in navigating that situation?
So that's another scenario too of how people find themselves kind of in that status, that they fall out of status. So people maybe come here with like a student visa or a tourist visa, and then they overstay their status for whatever reason. And yes, they kind of find themselves in a situation where they now try to maybe immigrate through a spouse, maybe a U.S. citizen spouse or another relative. And so that's another example as well.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the greatest challenges that your clients are facing as they are seeking and securing representation?
Yes. I would say the main two things that I see is a lack of legal reform. Sometimes their options are very limited, or maybe they have none. And the other is a lack of resources. Hiring an attorney can be very expensive, and paying the application fees can also be very difficult for many. So I would say those are the two main challenges that I see.
And those of us who try to follow some of these issues and educate ourselves, there are so many legal turns and regulations, and if we're not in that literature, it can seem really overwhelming. What, in your opinion, are some of the biggest legal reforms that would make a big difference if they were addressed?
One main thing that I can think of right now is I would say a pathway for those people who have been here for many years without any sort of criminal history and who have to consular process, which means that they came in without status. And so now they have, if they're immigrating through a family member, now they have to go abroad to a US embassy or US consulate for an interview. A lot of those people have US citizen children. So they wait many, many years until their child turns 21, thinking that their child can help them. But unfortunately, since they have to go abroad, they're subject to a 10-year bar. So just to kind of, so the problem there is that you, to avoid that 10-year bar, you can seek a provisional waiver, but that waiver is only available for those with a qualifying relative. And that includes spouses or parents, US citizens or residents who are qualifying relatives. So for example, they can, you know, a child can petition for them, but now they can't go abroad because they don't qualify for that waiver based on their child. And so now they're pretty much stuck here. They don't have that qualifying relative, and or they can go abroad for 10 years, which obviously not a lot of people want to do that and leave their family, you know, for 10 years. So that's kind of one area that I see a lot when I, you know, when, as I have people come in and they think, you know, they waited all these years, their child turns 21 and they think they can immigrate. And unfortunately they can't because they don't qualify for that provisional waiver. So it's like, they're stuck, they're in limbo right now.
Are there any other big, I'm sure you have a long list, but any other really core legal reforms that would really help the clients that you serve?
Yeah, so I have a lot of clients who arrived as children, so DACA. And I think just a pathway for them. I mean, there are some that have no other options at the moment. So really, they're just kind of waiting, you know, for that reform. They're waiting for these lawsuits to be resolved and so that they can just move on with their lives. So I think reform for them as well would be very beneficial. They have, I mean, they were brought here as children. They sometimes don't have any other options. And they, yes, they have a work permit, but they don't have a legal pathway to like a permanent solution. So I think that they're another group of people that I deal with often that would really benefit from legal reform.
The other thing we often hear is how much time is required to move through some of these processes. Can you speak to that? Like what, how long and involved is the process of legalizing status, and why does it take so long?
Oh yes, it's very long right now. I mean, certain processes, it really does depend on the process, but you know, since 2020, COVID did not help. So a lot of things got really backed up. I'll give you an example, that hardship waiver I was mentioning. Before 2020, it was maybe like a 10 to 12 month waiting period. And now it's a 3.5 years for that waiver to be approved. And so that's just very, and it's a lack of, I believe a lack of employees too within USCIS, US Citizenship and Immigration Services. So just a lack of resources. They are just really behind, I think, in processing these applications. Another example is just, I think processing times double, tripled since COVID. So I think it's just a lot of maybe layoffs and lack of resources. And also another example is people who have gone abroad, who have to go abroad for an interview at a U.S. consulate or embassy. So sometimes it's not USCIS, but sometimes it's the U.S. embassy or consulate that's just really backed up because a lot of them closed, you know, for 2020, 2021. And so they just got really behind. And when they reopened, they're just scheduling, you know, for those people who had canceled interviews. And so those waiting periods, let's say, went from like a year to maybe, again, 3 years. So it's just everything is really behind. There have been some improvements in certain areas, but it's just, I think then we can definitely improve in that. So it's unfortunate because sometimes clients do get a little impatient and they think that maybe we have something to do with it, but it's like sometimes it's out of our hands. And so we just have to explain to them that there are just really long waiting periods with some of these processes. So it's really just a waiting game.
And are you helping with obtaining work visas, those kind of temporary
like employment authorization documents? So yes, for certain types of cases, they are eligible. So it depends if they're eligible for an employment authorization document while they are waiting for their case to be adjudicated. So yes, we definitely help with that. If they qualify, that's one of the main things that we do is we help them get that employment card so that way they can start working as soon as possible while they're waiting for their case to be processed, since it does take a long time.
And are there long wait times for those as well?
For certain cases, yes. Some cases, for example, people seeking asylum, they do have to wait 5 months after they sent their asylum application before they're eligible for a work permit. And then it takes maybe 2-3 months. So I would say minimum, yes, people are waiting about 8 months. And then sometimes cases could take a year for their employment card to come in. So
Yeah. So a lot of issues there. You know, your average person listening to this may not have 8 months of salary saved up. You know, I know you can't speak about specific cases, but I wonder if you have an example, something that's common that speaks to the consequences of someone not having legal representation, not finding someone like you, or having a hard time getting together the funds for representation. What have you seen can happen?
Yes, I unfortunately see that a lot in the areas of asylum. So asylum seekers, there is just a lack of legal representation. Attorneys are overwhelmed with these cases. And so we sometimes we just can't take them all, right? So there's just, I see that there. I also see there's a recent case. Obviously, I can't give names out or anything like that, but there is that illustrates just kind of the consequences of maybe not having legal representation. And it's actually turned into a success story of this client who was brought to my attention because he was local. He was detained by ICE for a crime that he did commit over almost 30 years ago. But just now they detained him and he was placed in removal proceedings. He was put in ICE detention over in Bakersfield. And so it was really difficult for him to find legal representation. He was scheduled for a hearing before an immigration judge while in detention. And so he pretty much was going to move forward and represent himself. He was brought to my attention by the family members, and I was just really motivated to help. And so we filed a packet and we were able to get him released on bond. And so I was able to help him out kind of at the last minute before his hearing. And I mean, when you don't have legal representation, you kind of trying to navigate this on your own. And I mean, he would have probably just been removed, you know, and his, and he was a single father, so his children would have been left here by himself. So, you know, now he's released and now he can fight his case outside of court. But now it's a success story as well, because we, you know, he found legal representation at the last minute, was able to turn things around and not be deported.
If you're just joining us, you are tuned in to Bending the Arc on KKRN, KKRN.org, community radio out of Round Mountain and Bella Vista, California. And in this episode of Bending the Arc, we're speaking with immigration lawyer Tanya Narciso, who works in Shasta County.
How do people typically find you? Is a lot of it through word of mouth of people who trust you? How does that work? It seems such a fraught and scary process to find someone that you can trust.
That is very true. So a lot of it is by recommendations, personal recommendations, referrals. I am on online Google and I have a website, but I think the trust is obviously an important component. And so a lot of it is by referral. So cases I've worked on, and then they refer other people to me who they just end up trusting me through other people. So I think that's very true what you mentioned, because unfortunately in this area, a lot of people get taken advantage of, and there are attorneys who do, take advantage of these vulnerable people. So I think it trust is an important component in finding an attorney.
And you mentioned asylum, and I wanted to ask you about that. Are those the asylum cases you're most likely that you have most often now, are they people seeking asylum from particular communities or countries, or are there more individual cases?
So what I see mostly, or what the type of people that come through my office a lot, is Mexico, people from Mexico, because it's the nearest, one of the nearest borders. I get a lot of people from the Northern Triangle. So those are people from Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras. That's kind of like the main, the, I would say the majority of my clients are from those areas.
And the majority are also seeking asylum given the conditions where they live?
So mostly based on past persecution. So that's if they were with maybe threatened or harmed by, whether it's their government or maybe individuals back home, and so they're seeking protection.
So it could be an individual persecution.
Yeah.
Or we hear a lot about
political instability, maybe the government. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I really appreciate the case that you shared with us, that both highlights some of the challenges and the consequences of not having it, but also what can happen when those connections are made. What is most challenging for you about doing this work? You know, you mentioned helping people who are becoming aware of how long it takes, what is required, what's not possible, people who are really in vulnerable situations and often not able to work for many months. How do you navigate those situations and the emotions involved?
Yeah, I would have to say that you really do have to have obviously compassion for these people, but at the same time not take it home with you, you know, that, because vicarious trauma is very real. So I think just kind of trying to help and not dwell and not sit there and obviously cry with them, but mostly just help them and have hope for legal reform. Honestly, just try to give them some hope. And if there's nothing that I can help them with, at least, you know, let them know just to remain hopeful and some sort of change. But it is really tough sometimes when you have to let someone know that there's really nothing that I could do in the moment. But I just also looking back at the times where I have been able to help people and just the change and hope and that this brings. And I think that that really just kind of keeps me motivated, I would say, is also just remaining hopeful.
Yeah. Well, and I, you know, I'm in the Shasta Equal Justice Coalition, we often talk about how so many of the equity and justice related issues that we're passionate about are really long hauls, and they're full body experiences. There's heart, mind, body. It's can be very hard and persistent work, and that self-care and having practices to navigate those challenges are really critical to sustaining those efforts. So I wonder if there are any practices that help you. You know, you mentioned reflecting on things that have worked well, engaging in action for reform. Are there any other things that you find helpful when you're faced with a challenging case?
I would say setting up boundaries as well, like work-life boundaries, my personal life, you know, my faith, my staying grounded, and you know, obviously family helps when I take advantage of weekends, for example, and family time. So I do think that setting up those boundaries and that balance in my life is really important, because otherwise as attorneys, we get really burnt out. And so trying to avoid that burnout and recognizing when maybe you're just taking on too many asylum cases or too many cases in a certain area, just having that balance and really separating the work life when you need to.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate you sharing that, because I think it's something that's important for us to talk more about in terms of, especially with all of these backlogs and needing as many people as we can, needing folks to be healthy and
yes,
well,
mentally, physically, super important.
Yeah. So, At the beginning, we were talking about this being a challenging time, say the past 8 years, to be practicing immigration law. And certainly we hear a fair amount of anti-immigration rhetoric from some voices. And I'm wondering about the other voices that don't get heard so much that are fighting for immigration reform or are speaking about the importance of immigration, given our demographics, economic needs, for a number of reasons. Who are you seeing, or what groups are speaking more loudly from a pro-immigration perspective?
I would say AILA, American Immigration Lawyers Association. It's a voluntary bar association. So it's comprised of like immigration attorneys, immigration law professors. So I'm actually a part of AILA, and they're constantly challenging a lot of these laws, like harmful laws and regulations. And so they're constantly filing lawsuits against, you know, laws that are harmful for immigrants. And so they are an organization that I really follow. And I mean, also like ACLU is another organization, American Civil Liberties Union. So these organizations fight for immigrant rights. So they are some of the organizations that I really follow.
Are there any any organizations that are not primarily composed of lawyers or legal representatives that have a larger voice in this arena that you know of?
A larger voice, not none that I can think of at the moment. But for example, there are some local ones. Well, when I was living in Sacramento, for example, FUEL, it's F Family Unity Education and Legal. So they're an organization that takes a lot of action with like local policies, and also they're very involved in the community. So I'm not saying they're bigger than like AILA or ACLU, but they're local, and I know that they also do a lot for the community.
Yeah, no,
Think of anyone else in the moment?
that's a great example. So the Shasta Equal Justice Coalition works for fair and equal justice, with a focus on criminal legal reform, locally, as well as statewide. There are lots of aspects of that. I'm wondering, in your experience, what are some of the greatest needs or areas where you see that fair and equal justice isn't being experienced?
I mean, locally, I think lack of resources for immigrants. So I would say, I mean, more nationwide, obviously, like lack of resources and detention centers. It's really difficult for them to get legal representation. And I mean, in Shasta County, I think there just are not enough organizations that help fund resources for immigrants, like shelters. I think even help with like legal fees, maybe even like a free DACA renewal and citizenship fairs. So I think those types of resources would be very beneficial for local people. You know, a lot of, I mean, we have a lot of immigrants in the community, and it's just sometimes they just don't return because they just can't afford legal representation or the application fees, et cetera. So, I mean, whether it's like maybe more nonprofits or just organizations funding, legal fees, I think would be really helpful.
So it sounds like you're also saying that another way that people can fall out of status is sometimes, or in some cases, lack of funding to renew, like the DACA renewal. And there's certainly been moments where people were advised not to renew DACA when the status was even more in question.
So I would say people could fall out of status that way for sure. So maybe they just don't are not eligible for renewal. And sometimes that could happen from like an arrest, you know, or criminal conviction. So sometimes people do fall out of status, yeah.
And are what do you hear from the people you serve about interactions with law enforcement? Either avoidance of resistance to reporting issues, or any additional attention that they might be receiving. Do you hear about situations like that?
Yes, I do. Sometimes, maybe a lack of enforcement when it comes to, for example, maybe domestic violence or certain areas. Sometimes I do see kind of like a lack of enforcement. Maybe they just don't see a follow-up, or they just don't get enough. I have seen that for sure. But there is obviously it's called a U visa, which is for victims of certain qualifying crimes who have reported and cooperated with law enforcement. It's a non-immigrant type of visa, which could lead to permanent status. So that kind of in a way encourages, immigrants to come out of the shadows and report crimes. So certain qualifying crimes that can help them with legalizing their status. So that is an area that maybe in a way kind of helps, but at the same time, some of them don't know about it, and so they're just scared to call the police because they think that they may call ICE or something, or they may get in trouble themselves. And so they a lot of people, yeah, still don't know about these resources that, could help them if they do report the crime. So see that a lot.
Yeah, and we have heard about from a public safety perspective, if you're not feeling safe to call law enforcement for whatever reason, it hampers the ability to follow up on those issues or to learn what's happening. And it sounds like those who are perhaps aware of the qualifying instances might report, but aren't those issues aren't necessarily being addressed in a or followed up on
Right.
in a prompt manner.
Yeah.
Can you point to any cities or counties that have a more positive relationship with those immigrating to those communities? We've heard a lot about sanctuary, non-sanctuary, welcoming cities, and then globally, some communities who recognize a real need for younger people, for labor, for a number of different reasons, encouraging immigration. What have you seen in California that might be an important place to look when we understand to think about options?
Yeah, I lived in Sacramento for many years, so I would say Sacramento is a good example. Sacramento has developed positive relationships with immigrants. I mentioned a little bit earlier the Sacramento Fuel Network. So that organization does, for example, they took action when recently, I don't know if you heard, the 16 migrants that were dropped off in front of the Sacramento Diocese office. So there are the Fuel Network is an organization that really took action. They reached out to local attorneys who were willing to offer like free consultations and legal representation for these people. And so they so Sacramento has a lot of really great organizations such as the Fuel Network. The Mexican consulate in Sacramento too, I worked with them a lot in the past, so they're also really involved in immigration matters. They host like DACA workshops, DACA renewal workshops, citizenship fairs. They offer funds also for like low-income individuals who need help with like consultations and legal representation. They actually have a network of attorneys that offer free consultations for people who go to the Mexican consulate seeking help. So they're really involved as well.
Yeah, and I know Latino Outreach of Tehama County has brought in the mobile Mexican consulate
Yes.
on occasion. That's been really helpful.
Yes.
What other organizations or resources can people access online as they're figuring out, do they need to see you right away? Do they need to get things together in order to see you, or even how to support others in the community who are experiencing challenges with legal status? You mentioned ILA and Fuel, and we'll put links to those
Yeah.
in the show notes.
Yeah, ACLU, I think also, USCIS has a lot of helpful information. So sometimes people go on there and kind of do their own research before they come in. And so they kind of have an idea of what the process is like. But also I have an explanation of other of various different areas or the I'm on my website. So I also have an explanation of kind of like the different areas that I practice in. And I think that's all I can think of at the moment.
Yeah, and what is your website for those who are listening and want to write it down? I'll put it in the notes as well, but
It's www.hopelawpc.org. www.kkrn.com. And so on the website, you'll find a section under services. And so it just, I highlight kind of like a little explanation of different types of services that I offer. So like whether it's asylum, a family-based petition, naturalization, removal defense, et cetera. So I have kind of like a little explanation of what each of those different services mean.
Perfect. Perfect. We'll definitely link to those. And if people are listening to this or organizations and want to support your work and or the people that you serve, what would be the best ways for them to do that?
I would say supporting organizations like AILA that we mentioned and ACLU. I mean, those donations really do help fund their litigation and advocacy, and their litigation is extremely helpful.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Well, and we'll have everything there if people want to refer folks to you. Is there anything I haven't asked you that's important to mention as we speak about immigration law, as we speak about the experience of community members who are working through their legal status?
I would just say it's important to work with local attorneys as well. I think, I mean, if they hear of anyone or if they know of anyone maybe who is trying to legalize their immigration status, I think, and you know, referring them to local attorneys, and I mean, I think that's important. And I think maybe just kind of having more of an open mind of the types of people that are here without legal status and not being so judgmental. I mean, I think sometimes people just don't know enough. Maybe they just haven't educated themselves enough into what that means. And also, for example, DACA, I think it's important to just educate ourselves in those types of areas. So that way we can work together and have less judgment, I think, amongst mm-hmm. each other.
Mm-hmm. Well, Tanya, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us. And you've shared a lot of really good resources that we'll put out there, and any others that you have as we communicate, we can continue to put those on the show notes. So thank you.
Thank you.
You have been listening to Bending the Arc on KKRN Community Supported Radio, supported by people like you. So please feel free to check out our guests' website, to go to kkrn.org, click the donate button. All of your support really helps us to have programs like these. Thank you so much.
And if you're still listening, we know you're a big community radio fan. And so I wanted to take a moment to reach out to you to let you know that this episode will soon be on our website, as are the others. And they're there for a reason. They're there so that you can find things that you listen to, want to listen to again, and definitely to share with others. We make a real attempt to make them resource rich. So the show notes will have the links that we mentioned, names so that you can refer back to them, and sometimes contact information for our speakers. And also, we are creating this for you. So if you would like to have more information about any of the speakers, if you have ideas for people that you would like us to interview, if you'd like more information about either KKRN or the Shasta Equal Justice Coalition, because you'd like to get involved, please do email us. You can contact us through our Facebook site, or you can email me directly at Sharon@inquirythatmatters.org. And I'll put that in the show notes as well. We'd love to hear about others in the community who are doing this kind of work, who would be willing to share their ideas with us. And the ideas on this show, we'll say when they attend as well, are the views of the people that we speak with and the host. They're not of KKRN, the Shasta Equal Justice Coalition, the Acorn Board, or any of our sponsors. Thank you so much for being a part of doing good in our community.
I believe in being ready. I believe in being ready. I believe in being ready, for the time is drawing near. Brothers, sisters, please get ready. Brothers, sisters, please get ready. Brothers, sisters, please get ready, for the time is drawing near. Oh, there'll be signs and